which at times is stunning, a spiritual power that derives in part from intellectual high spirits and good health, incomparable intellectual vitality overcome by the necessity of death. That was my non-Christian view of Jesus. Oh, I loved my Jesus, and I feared him too. The core readings I began to see could be arduous and demanding, all the more so if you lowered your guard and let the books hit you, and especially in middle age when demands such as those made by Jesus threatened the protective encrustation of habit. The middle age success, one of Jesus's prime targets, relied on his strengths, hid his weaknesses, and cut corners wherever he could. He observed the outward forms of the laws and wondered what was alive in his soul. I knew this person all too well, and although I was not ready to leave my family and follow anyone, I thought turning myself inside out might not be a bad idea. At least I could discover my limits and try to push beyond them. A good part of European and American history sprang out of these books of the New Testament. Wars, social organization, an immense amount of art and thought. And as I read through the Gospels, my initial elation gave way to unease. The reason was perfectly obvious. The Gospels and the Epistles, which were composed a little earlier, were written for embattled Christian groups, the newly converted and those who might be converted. Stevenson called on the most effective organizing tools ever invented. Within a few hundred years, the Roman Empire was Christian. In these most central of all Western texts, I was the enemy, the one who lacked human qualities and understanding. I was the other. Women and blacks have complained that the classic texts of the West cast them into roles that justified exclusion. And now this became my complaint, too. Columbia is treating the Old Testament as prelude to the New had not bothered me at all. But now, though loving Jesus as never before, I was spooked. Until about 70 A.D., the Christians understood themselves as a movement within Judaism. Out of the agony of the breakup, that bitter family quarrel or divorce, Christianity emerged as something separate. And the Gospels, written around the same time to give strength and comfort to those who might be facing persecution, turned the Jews, or at least the Pharisees, into the enemy. It wouldn't have been prudent to turn the Romans into the enemy. And so in the long corridor of European and then American history, the thrusting out from these books of institutions and wars and manners, including the rapid triumph of the new story of incarnation, death and resurrection over the Greco-Roman god systems. In that long corridor, the Jews, now a hated minority, were dragged along, occasionally converted, and then often under the threat of death, but also tortured, ghettoized, scapegoated, envied, demonized, annihilated. They were as much a part of the West as the Christians, but through all of history they were made to pay for handing Jesus over to the Romans and their refusal to accept him as the Messiah, Jesus the Son of God, who of course serves his divine function for Christians precisely because he was betrayed and crucified. The seeds of genuine hostility are here. The Old Testament itself was allowed into the Christian canon as a prelude only in the second century, when Christian theologians convinced themselves that it prefigured the New Testament, that the New, especially Matthew, might have been fashioned so as to conform to the old may not have been a notion many Christians were willing to grant. History had done its amazing work, incorporating into its triumphant, indifferent sweep the less powerful traditions of earlier civilizations. Suddenly I felt lost. Was it possible that I was a victim of hegemony and had simply never admitted it? It was December, and here I was piling up presents for the boys at the base of a Christmas tree. Just what I needed, I told myself. The tree was so large that my older son and I had to put it down on West End Avenue 5 or 6 times in the course of walking it home from nearby Broadway. In our living room, the tree scraped the ceiling and fir needles fell to the floor. The cats pawed at the needles and chewed on the ribbons around the presents. As the boxes mounted up, the children grew more excited. I was a secular Jew celebrating Christmas the way our family always did, and I was going around with an unpleasant pressure building inside my head. Chronologically, Lit Hum was way behind CC, so Professor Taylor took up the New Testament only in mid-January, as the initial Lit Hum reading of the second semester. Would he deal with such issues? Even if he did, I was sure his kind of formal, metaphoric analysis couldn't touch what was bothering me. Taylor wanted to discuss the connections between the Old and New Testaments. But first he went back to his opening day of the first semester, making the students pull out the sheet of quotations he had given them 4 months earlier. There it was again, the opening of Genesis. Adam and Eve were back in paradise, in a state of integritas. There was no conflict between what they wanted to do and what they ought to do. Throughout your life, he said, looking around at the students, his baritone curling upward, throughout your life, people have been saying to you, why can't you be more like Adam in Eden? And by that he meant that people demanded of themselves and others an impossible consistency and simplicity and an undivided will. But you have these splits right, he said. Because Adam and Eve ate the apple, and then man falls into time, and he falls into dualities. And he handed out another sheet, this time with copies of the poem Original Sequence by the contemporary American poet Philip Booth. The poem begins, time was the apple Adam ate, and ends, Eve held the twisted stem, the pulp. She heard the low snake hiss and let fly blindly with a woman arm, careless where her new won anger struck. The fodder for that twofold flock fell, an old brown core at God's stopped feet. He reached and wound the clock. See, he said, God wound the clock, and time starts. When you fall from the Garden of Eden, as any poet can tell you, you fall into time. Time was the apple Adam ate, and you fall into dualities. Everything comes in opposing pairs. Remember the opening of Genesis, light and darkness, land and seas. God was doing a job of long division on the universe, good and evil too. Milton, in that quotation from Areopagitica that I gave you on opening day, said that good and evil were part of each other. It was from out of the rind of one apple tasted that the knowledge of good and evil as two twins cleaving together leaped forth into the world. And perhaps this is the doom which Adam fell into of knowing good and evil. That is to say, of knowing good by evil. You have to be expelled from Eden to know sin. You've got to have evil in order to have love and charity. Taylor had been teaching Lit Hum for many years and had built up a language, a set of references, reaching forward and backward that held the books together, as if the course itself were a kind of epic poem with its own organic structure, its difficulties and mysteries that could be penetrated by a student alert enough to pick up the hints. In class, he could jump from one thing to another because he had his epic poem version of the course in his head. Would his poem speak to me this time? I doubted it. Taylor was often winging now, and a couple of students who had shifted into his section in the middle of the year-long course looked puzzled, almost shocked, especially a student named Judith Sterngold, who was not shy about expressing her opinions. She cocked her head sideways and stared at Taylor silently. Look, he said, the Greek gods screwed around like us. They were like us. But in the Old Testament, there's a gap between man and God. God says to Job, you weren't there when I created the universe, and you don't know. Into that gap will step Jesus. Jesus embodies it. He is both man and God, and he explains it. Then he started firing questions at them, and they rose to the task, making a literary structure out of the Gospels and their relation as language and metaphor to the Old Testament. They were alive to this heady talk of time and doubling, and he worked his rabbit out of the hat trick, ignoring the answers that went awry, picking one word or phrase out of a wayward answer and building something, getting the other students to respond to it. What is the point of the genealogy at the beginning of Matthew? He asked. It begins, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and so on. The point is to establish that Jesus descended from King David, right? Why is this necessary if he's the son of God? Sterngold now came alive. How can Jesus later be called the Lord of David, she asked. David came earlier, before Jesus. This comes out of another concept than the one I know from the Hebrew Bible. I don't understand this concept of God where things exist at two points in time. Taylor looked delighted. Judith Sterngold was holding her head. Why are you holding your head? Paradox, said Sterngold irritably. Yes, paradox makes you hold your head. Look, Miss Sterngold, no one is trying to convert you. That's not what we do here. You may doubt that God did this, but you can't doubt that it's a description of the universe in which you live. She smiled slightly. Okay. You fall into time, said Taylor. Jesus says, in effect, your time is clocks. My time is not yet. It's not my time to go to Jerusalem. There is the appointed time and the chronological time. Kairos and Chronos. God dropped Jesus into time. He is the walking paradox, both God and man. He is eternity in time. So now you're messing with time. You lose life in order to gain it. Jesus is Lord of David who came earlier because eternity has intervened in chronological time. Sterngold was still staring at him. You've all been brought up to think single as if you were in the Garden of Eden. Think double. You've fallen into dualities. Jesus as teacher is doing what? He's busting your head. And here he looked at Sterngold again. He's saying you don't have eyes to see or ears to hear. He will teach you by going over the line into death, and you have to accept it. As I listened to him, I felt my ache fading away. He was giving us the version of time and history that Christianity brought into Western consciousness, a way of conceiving of time that had an immense influence on theology and literature, at least through the Renaissance. And the scheme was dazzling. Here was an example of hegemony in operation. Sterngold's way of thinking about time had yielded to another, and one might describe it, analyze it, unmask it. One could not do much more than that. The Christian mode of thinking had shaped literature and art and institutions. It had been woven through history, could not be shaken out. It had woven itself into me, too. We were propelled into the Christian world. Look at the beginning of John, Taylor said. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. This is a spectacular opening, a violent, scandalous revision of the opening of Genesis. The Gospels were written in Greek, and in Greek the word is logos, a most powerful word to the highly cultivated Greco-Roman audience that was likely to read John. Look, the entire civilization of the Greeks, logos, gets dropped into this one man, and the Word was made flesh. That's the big turn from the Greco-Roman civilization. This is a religion that's going to take over, Taylor said, summing up. The Emperor Constantine converts, and the Roman Empire becomes the Holy Roman Empire. They're going to take over South America, North America, and if they can't convert them, they're going to burn them. It couldn't have taken over the world without a new view of time and history. He presented the framework of the Christian triumph. It was a double focus. He unmasked and celebrated the mask at the same time. And amazingly, I was soothed. My unhappiness dimming rapidly soon went away altogether. Anti-Semitism was a catastrophe and a disgrace, but to remain indignant over the success of Christianity, I couldn't do it. One cannot reasonably fight history, the configuration of what was with the imagination of what wasn't, a futile and despairing act. History was always excluding somebody. By most definitions, it was a record of victory of one force or group over another, which doesn't mean that one accepts injustice, only that one could not fashion one's being around historical memory. At least I couldn't. Even after much reading and some writing about the Holocaust, and a terrifying visit to Auschwitz, and considerable attention to the anti-Semitic remarks of Pat Robertson, Pat Buchanan, and Louis Farrakhan, I could not, without serious inauthenticity, think of myself as a victim of anti-Semitism. Not in America, not in New York. I could, and should, think of myself as a Jew, but not as a victim. What mattered now was survival and the ability to flourish, and no one could say that the Jews, after ages of bitterness and sorrow, had not survived and flourished in America. I was lucky, I told myself. Lucky, lucky, lucky. An American Jew, protected by the country's traditions of tolerance and by its constitutional refusal of a state religion. This reading of sacred texts in secular courses was a bumpy ride. I'd got thrown around rather harder than I wanted, and I had the bruises to show for it. But at least I felt my body. I knew it was there, and I could no longer say my identity was entirely lost in the media fog. Judith Sterngold, a student in Taylor's class who had held her head when confronted with the paradoxes of the New Testament, was indignant again. "Where is Dante coming from?" she asked. Enjoying her moment of effrontery, she smiled slightly, her head cocked to the side. She had dark hair, very large eyes, and a way of staring at you when she spoke that was almost unnerving. She was a very direct woman. "Why is he so obsessed with these people? Who is he to come up with these tortures?" She was speaking of the Inferno, the first part of Dante's Divine Comedy, the third Lit Hum reading of the new semester, after the New Testament and Augustine. As she spoke, I sighed deeply. The great Christian epic is a flabbergasting work, crazily methodical, both sublime and grotesque, cruel, dismaying, a work that bursts the usual moral and literary categories. In the Inferno, Dante created the topography of hell with levels of pain and suffering appropriate to every sin, and he put into his landscape of punishment not only historical figures and characters from mythology, but also his contemporaries. "These are real people in Florence," said Taylor. "He's getting at those people he hates," she said, "and he puts it in a religious context to make it seem like a religious work. He's covering up his hatred." Part of me agreed with her. I was amazed by the Inferno. Everyone was amazed by it, by the frights, the obscenities, the filth and effluvia of a vision in which execration was often the central act of perception, and suffering the central spectacle of desire. The sinners, the lustful, gluttonous, treacherous, are caught forever. Forever. One had to remind oneself of that. In this passage set in the eighth circle, serpents surround and tear at thieves who catch fire, burn, and are then reconstituted like the phoenix. But when they are reborn out of their own ashes, they only suffer again. Among this cruel and depressing swarm ran people who were naked, terrified, with no hope of a hole or heliotrope. Their hands were tied behind by serpents. These had thrust their head and tail right through the loins, and then were knotted on the other side. And there, a serpent sprang with force at one who stood upon our shore, transfixing him just where the neck and shoulders form a knot. No O or I has ever been transcribed so quickly as that soul caught fire and burned and, as he fell, completely turned to ashes. And when he lay undone upon the ground, the dust of him collected by itself and instantly returned to what it was. Just so it is asserted by great sages that when it reaches its 500th year, the phoenix dies and is reborn again. Lifelong it never feeds on grass or grain, only on drops of incense or amomum. Its final winding sheets are nard and myrrh. And just as he who falls, and knows not how, by demon's force that drags him to the ground, or by some other hindrance that binds man, who, when he rises, stares about him, all bewildered by the heavy anguish he has suffered, sighing as he looks around, so did this sinner stare when he arose. Oh, how severe it is, the power of God, that as its vengeance showers down such blows. So much suffering and obscene torment. And what was Dante's relation to it? The students were shocked, for all this terror is set forth in the name of primal love. And no matter how hard some of them tried, they could not find love in the Inferno. Dante, a great religious writer, outraged all their pieties. And for once, though uneasily, I thought they were right. Like some of Dante's sinners, the schismatics to be precise, I was split down the middle. At the beginning of my year in school, I had promised myself that my own pleasure would be the principle and motive of what I celebrated. No bowing before idols, no piety without enjoyment. Joyless appreciation was the academic curse, and I would not fall under it. I would stick to my own belief. Pleasure is the way of knowledge, which meant I would admit when I did not enjoy something and had not learned from it. But pleasure needs cultivation. Pleasure might be inadequate, and for the first time, I thought pleasure could be shaped by ignorance. My pleasures might be too limited to read Dante. In Lit Hum, you fall by not rising, or in Professor Taylor's terms, you shrink by not stretching yourself enough to read a work that lies outside your expectations. You see not what is unique about the work, but only how it differs from those expectations. In effect, you're reading yourself. Oh, Narcissus, the book becomes your reflecting pool. I knew I was in danger of falling in. Most serious work of the Italian Middle Ages was composed in Latin, but Dante, in a radical break, wrote in the vernacular, in Florentine Italian. Like so much revolutionary work in the arts, the poem offers a violent shift downward, down to the vernacular, the body, the common emotions, and the common life. And it's the kind of shift that creates an entire new literature, and perhaps brings a new way of life into being. For T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden, for Christian Goss, Edmund Wilson's teacher at Princeton, and for millions of readers and scholars, the Divine Comedy was the central literary work of the Christian era. At 18, I had accepted the Inferno as the expression of a fervently passionate medieval belief. In order to read it, I told myself I didn't need to believe as a Florentine of 1300 believed. The poem was an enthralled structure of fear and hope, and Dante himself was split between terror of sin and obsession with punishment. I remember admiring Dante's mood of somber dread and even enjoying sections that were cruelly funny, so exact and detailed about the monstrous and deformed. I would read the poem as a metaphor. It had nothing to do with me. In 1961, Lit Hum students read a prose translation by the Scot John D. Sinclair, and the Inferno's stature as great poetry was never raised in class as an issue. But now I saw that I had gotten it wrong. The way I had dealt with it as a freshman was trivial and complacent, because you couldn't just read it metaphorically, as an allegory, as moral drama. You had to read it, first of all, as a poetic literalization of the unspeakable, a giant created reality that was at the same time a reflection of life on earth. Dante's hell was arranged by circles, concentric circles dug into the earth in the shape of a funnel. At the top of the funnel on the surface of the earth lay Jerusalem, the place of Jesus Christ's death. At the bottom, at mid-earth, Satan's realm, the ninth and lowest circle. One progressed downward into greater degrees of sin and punishment, a torment set aside for every vice and error, ending at the frozen pit where even tears turn to ice. There at the bottom, three-headed Lucifer chews on Brutus and Cassius, the betrayers of Caesar, and on Judas, who betrayed Christ. The Inferno was both the opening section of Dante's cosmic geometaphysical plan. Two other gigantic poems followed, and a table of ethical values. In Shapiro's class, Rebecca, who thought that literature should be fair, dug her hands into her hair and asked, "How can a religion preaching forgiveness condemn someone to hell forever?" And Christine Wong, a well-read girl from Singapore who spoke quietly but firmly, now said that there are mosques in hell. Dante is Turk-bashing. I don't think he's writing religiously at all. And she might have pointed out that Muhammad himself shows up in Canto 28 as one of the schismatics, one of whom is split open from chin to where we fart, his bowels hung between his legs. One saw his vitals in the miserable sack that makes of what we swallow, excrement. No sooner are Muhammad, his nephew Ali, and the other schismatics healed than they are split open again. Shapiro's students insisted that Dante, the sin assessor, was himself guilty of the sin of cruelty. The lawgiver was himself lawless, operating without the constraints that they, the students, operated under, the constraints of tolerance, which forbade hating anyone. They valued openness and respect more than genius, and their notion of religion was naive. Religion was simply moral, an area of ethical transcendence removed from the rest of life. Alone among Shapiro's students, Henry, a Baptist from Maryland, put a little steel into religion. Henry said that the militant Jesus, in his call to listeners to drop everything and follow, implied punishment of those who stayed behind. Many of the students used tolerance to cover what they didn't understand. They were Americans, taught to respect all traditions, so they thought of Christianity as one religion among many. You could take it or leave it, you could choose. This may be true now, and it may be the proper attitude in a country whose constitution guarantees freedom of conscience. But in the European Middle Ages, Christianity was practically everything, good and evil, hatred and love, learning and entertainment. It was omnivorous, not something separate from life, but a force stretching to the horizons, a means of seeing all the rest. In the age of faith, choice was hardly an issue. The action of the Inferno begins on April 7, 1300, on Good Friday, the day of Christ's crucifixion, and ends on Easter Sunday, the day of resurrection. Dante placed himself within the Christian cosmology. He stands between past and present and looks to an apocalyptic future. Shapiro finally became exasperated with the students' politically correct ecumenical notions. "Everybody's a Christian, guys. It's not a sermon, but Pope, politics, and religion are all bound together. It's a Christian poem written for a Christian audience in a Christian framework." They held back. They hid. For instance, they all, as modern persons, accepted sex, accepted the body, but they accepted it only theoretically. They were too far away from an age that could hate the body by doctrine, yet live in the body without inhibition, with a full raging acceptance of the physical as necessity. Shapiro went after them, insisting that the Inferno was one of the great works about physical existence. "Bodies become unclean," he said, lifting his head and almost crowing. "They have sex with the wrong partners, with people of the same sex. There is illicit sex, too much sex. They are violent. They defecate. They eat. Things are being stuck into faces. The body is a weird container from which things come out. Students looked grim, but the coach pressed on cheerfully. The bodies can feel pain, pain of dismemberment, freezing, being shackled. Where does the pleasure come in? The body is conceived as the map of sin, not of pleasure. The system of punishment was as brilliant as it was repellent. Dante's announced method of body torment was called contrapasso, literally counterpenalty. The punishment fit the crime. But the working out of contrapasso came closer, and this was a profound stroke, to the punishments becoming the crime. The process began in life. By sinning, you gave yourself over to obsession, and obsession was disfiguring. Sin showed up in your face and limbs, a notion that expressed both primitive fears and a remarkable insight into the way the body shapes itself around the deformations of the psyche. In hell, the process goes the final step. The sinner becomes his sin. His character is fulfilled in death. You die and become yourself. And the living poet, Dante, confronts each of the dead and sees him in essence without worldly protection. Shapiro kept after them, insisting on the true nature of the poem, using misunderstanding as a prelude to understanding, and some of them came around. But I groaned to myself at the end of this exercise. I was miserable, because while seeing much that was limited in their way, and Sterngold's way of reading the Inferno, I was helpless to offer an alternative. I got something of a reprieve, however, a moment of pleasure. One of Shapiro's students, Francesca, a tall young woman with ripely rosy lips and a head of tousled hair, spoke English so well, with so little accent, that I had hardly noticed that she was Italian. In his final class on Dante, the coach asked her to read the opening of the Inferno, and as she read the first 30 lines or so of Canto 1, the room fell quiet. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, mi ritrovai per una selva oscura, che la diritta via era smarrita, ai quanto a dir qual era e cosa dura, esta selva selvaggia e aspra e forte, che nel pensier rinnova la paura, tant è amara che poco è più morte, ma per trattar del ben chi vi trovai. Dirò dell'altre cose chi vo scorte. Io non so ben ridir come vintrai. Tant'era pien di sono a quel punto che la verace via abbandonai. So now you've heard it, or something like it. In any case, you've heard something. Francesca read with no great stress or emphasis. She read in a low, steady voice, lower and flatter than her normal speaking voice, but the sound was uncanny. It was like a ravishing melody on a viola, the music arising unbidden from the quiet, low tones. No, this isn't happening. It can't be. It's too perfect a moment. But it was happening. The students were silent, and as she read, her eyes facing down on the page, her high coloring rose higher, and the music of Dante's Italian, embedded in the language, effortlessly floated into the room. Taylor and Shapiro taught us to read epic poetry for structure and significance, for symbolic energy and dramatic weight. Like most lit-hum teachers, they talked only rarely about metrics and almost never about the sound of poetry. We were working in translation, so what would be the point? As far as lit-hum was concerned, beginning students needed to tackle these arduous works without mourning the elements that they might be missing. A certain diminution by translation was taken for granted, but so strong was the sound of Dante's poetry that it made me feel I wasn't reading the poem at all. In Alan Mandelbaum's English, the power of the poem, the geographical and sensuous disposition of torment, came through, but not the sweetness, the love of life that made Dante a universal writer for so many people. The beauty of his Italian must have been the greatest sign of that love. Professor Marina Van Zylen sat at a small dark brown academic desk, a table really, and faced the students grouped in front of her. "You've all turned into little Augustines of late," she said. "You are all very moral, but you still retain the right to rebel. You say, why were we born with these bodies and these members if not to use them?" Well, it was about time. What had been missing in the core readings up until now was sex. Except for Sappho's sly and charming provocations and the tormented bonds between husbands and wives in the Greek tragedies, and the few extraordinary passages in the Aeneid, which, all in all, was far more copious on the subject of Dido's grief than her pleasure, whereas Aeneas seemed barely capable of pleasure at all, and a very few wistful glances backward by the sinners in Dante's hell. Except for those moments, there had been little of Eros, at least not in the immediate bodily sense. Eros, the force of life, the builder of cities, the heroic striver, Eros as metaphor of universal creative energy, had been everywhere. But the imp of lust appeared mainly as a dangerous impulse in unreliable gods or as a threat to Christian salvation. We had read several of St. Paul's searing epistles, and his loathing of the flesh echoed mightily through Augustine and Dante. The flesh had to be tamed, subdued, for it was dangerous. Hell on earth, and a possible prelude to eternal damnation. And we had seen little of joy either. Tragedy and epic, history and philosophy, the core readings, with the exceptions of the comedies of the Greek playwright Aristophanes, were grave and intense. It would have been easy enough, I suppose, for students to assume that gravity and intensity were the exclusive qualities of greatness. We saw ourselves reading serious books. It was no surprise then that few of the students had yet to realize that seriousness and fun were not opposed to one another. As they began to discuss Boccaccio, some of the students were dismissive. Not in Van Zylen's class, but in another section I even heard several male students refer to Giovanni Boccaccio's erotic stories as trash. A comic sexual writer. Boccaccio was a double blow to their solemnity. A few of the young men in particular were so forbidding, they might have been bankers turning down a loan request. One bright young man spoke of debauchery. Boccaccio was new to me, and still in a sour mood over my misadventure with Dante, I began to read him without expecting much. One of the minor authors on the Lit Hum list, I thought. Lit Hum had given us a selection from the Decameron, the collection of 100 stories, mostly erotic, that Boccaccio composed in the 1530s. Boccaccio used nothing less than the bubonic plague as a frame. To escape the ravages of the disease, a small group of aristocratic young men and women withdraw from Florence to the countryside and amuse one another by telling racy tales while living in perfect propriety. They are not prigs or hypocrites. They are keeping certain possibilities alive. The cheerfulness forges ahead against a background of terror. Boccaccio affirms the primal energies of life in the midst of universal death. The fourth story I read in the group assigned by Lit Hum, chapter 7 from book 2, was about a sultan's daughter with 9 husbands. The sultan's daughter? Reading Boccaccio, I was astonished to feel within a few pages an immense surge of relief. And Marina Van Zylen's term, sensation, began to waken unused limbs. I quickly revived. Boccaccio is a joyous writer. He's also an ironic writer. There was something he believed that should be immediately obvious to the reader, and he treated it with dignified reserve as if it were a secret. What he believed was as troublesome in the 1990s for some readers as it must have been for a great many readers 600 years earlier, that women were avid for sex as men. Not all women. There were those who stayed home with their knitting, but the brave ones were as determined to have their way with their partners of choice as men were. Of course, women weren't always free to do what they wanted, and in his gravely courteous introduction, Boccaccio provides some practical instruction. Kept under the thumb of husbands, brothers, and parents, women cannot easily move about, so they must learn to manage their lives cunningly. In many of the tales, women initiate the intrigues that lead to earthly paradise. They dissemble or put on disguises. They lie in bed at night next to inadequate husbands, with strings tied to their toes and hanging out of the window so lovers can summon them to meetings. They hide men in chests and closets, or meet them in caverns or gardens or on balconies. They create fictions and illusions, the verbal paraphernalia of sexual love. The women were great makers of fiction in their lives as well as their speech. Restricted yet endlessly resourceful, they are the true heirs to Odysseus. They make their own stories and in some cases tell their own stories. Not all Boccaccio's stories are of this nature. There are plenty of randy men, too. But in general, sex in Boccaccio is about will and desire, not seduction. And the women are heroines. Boccaccio is a writer of fables who wants to arouse his readers to exercise their freedom. Even the sultan's daughter, who is, as far as we can tell, passive before her fate, enjoys a kind of freedom. Nothing roguish or coy here. The story is swift, plain, and almost viciously funny. The sultan of Babylon gives his beautiful daughter Alatiel in marriage to the king of Algarve. But on her way across the Mediterranean to meet her future husband, the lady is shipwrecked in a storm. She washes up on the shores of Majorca, where to her relief, she's rescued from the beach by a local nobleman. He cannot understand or speak her language, but he establishes her in his castle, and one night after getting her drunk at a banquet, he climbs into bed by her side. Earlier she had resisted, but now she enjoys making love to him. This happy situation is disrupted, however, by the appearance of the nobleman's handsome younger brother, who is so amazed by Alatiel's beauty that he murders his kinsman and takes Alatiel off for himself. Boccaccio presents this as another calamity for her, like the shipwreck, though again she is consoled in bed. And so it goes, with one nobleman after another falling in love with Alatiel and killing the previous husband and bearing her off. It is a comedy of disgrace. The men, violating every precept of morality and hospitality, prey on their brothers, friends, masters, and leaders. They are so inflamed by lust that they kill, and then so inflamed by killing that they immediately make love to their prize. War and chaos follow in the wake of these acts. The tale is a celebration of Eros, the conqueror and destroyer. All these scandalous and lawless goings-on are narrated without judgment or shock, but with a brisk attention to the details of intrigue, as if murder and kidnapping were mere matters of technique. Being determined to move swiftly, he thrust aside all regard for reason and fair play, and concentrated solely on cunning. And one day, in furtherance of his evil designs, he made arrangements with one of the prince's most trusted servants, Ciarachi by name, to have all his horses and luggage placed secretly in readiness for a sudden departure. During the night, he and a companion, both fully armed, were silently admitted by the aforesaid Ciarachi into the prince's bedroom. It was a very hot night, and although the woman was asleep, the prince was standing completely naked at a window overlooking the sea, taking advantage of a breeze that was blowing from that quarter. The duke, having told his companion beforehand what he had to do, stole quietly across the room as far as the window, drove a dagger into the prince's back with so much force that it passed right through his body, and catching him quickly in his arms, he hurled him out of the window. In G.H. McWilliams' translation, Boccaccio's prose moves as rapidly as that dagger. The story turns out to be an erotic fairy tale with a dark, mischievous layer of irony. Each of these male masters of technique, showing off his beautiful wife, treats her as a possession and is promptly dispossessed of her. A Helen of Troy whom no one can hold on to. Elizabeth Taylor in her salad days. She survives all her lovers intact in her innocence and pleasure. In this story, it is the men who are violated by other men. What does Alatiel feel? That is Boccaccio's second ironic joke. He keeps himself distant, offering nothing in the way of psychology, only the elaborate insistence on Alatiel's calamities and misfortunes. covering the apparent truth that she remains as indifferent to propriety as her lovers. Lottiel, we surmise, has a good time in bed with the inflamed men. Her pleasure is her revenge and her salvation, and she enjoys a comic apotheosis. Restored to her father after years of this strange traveling existence, she constructs a preposterous story about living with nuns and defending her virginity, and is truly married at last as a virgin to her original husband, the poor, patient king of Algarve. The story ends as follows. And so, despite the fact that 8 separate men had made love to her on thousands of different occasions, she entered his bed as a virgin and convinced him that it was really so. And for many years afterwards, she lived a contented life as his queen. Hence the saying, a kissed mouth doesn't lose its freshness, for like the moon, it always renews itself. I have chosen this story from among those assigned to us precisely because it is the most vulnerable to contemporary dismissal. Is it not a story of repeated rape? After all, no one seeks Alatiel's consent. Shouldn't Boccaccio, like the poor, unfashionable genius Rabelais, be thrown out of the canon of acceptable works? But Boccaccio did not mean the tale as a chronicle of rape. We can see from as many other stories that women who are displeased with men do something about it. They climb down from balconies, they put on disguises, take lovers, and then they stand up in court and defend themselves against the charge of adultery. They also at times refuse lovers. Presumably, Alatiel, if unhappy, would have acted as well. The unspoken assumption of Alatiel's pleasure is exactly what makes the story of her calamity so funny. One has to read the story not in light of our own preconceptions about sex and power, but against the background of medieval Christian society, in which well-born women were not meant to enjoy sex. The saying, quoted above from the end of the story, might even be an explicit rebuke to Dante. A woman's sexual existence does not show in her face. You aren't marked by sin for all time. Boccaccio was born just outside Florence while Dante was still alive, and he loved Dante greatly, a kind of proto-Renaissance humanist. He produced encyclopedic works in Latin and early versions of psychological novels, but he also wrote the first great commentary on the Divine Comedy while rejecting the punitive medieval Christian fatalism of which Dante was the poetic master. In Boccaccio's tales, the body is not betrayed by sex, nor are flesh and spirit opposed, as in so much Christian literature. Sexuality is associated with strength, not weakness of character. God meant you to fulfill yourself on earth, and chastity is a mere waste. Boccaccio banished the churchly division of women into virgin and whore, and in its place celebrates the fleshly woman who gets what she wants. I discovered a scandalous text. And the scandal had not gone away, but merely changed its form. Something written 650 years ago had risen up and bitten us in a vulnerable spot. By insisting that sex was primarily about pleasure, not about power, Boccaccio subverts our most solemn pieties. In his stories, sex could level the most awesome social walls. Well-born women make love to valets and stable boys, and then speak defiantly to their possessive husbands. Boccaccio was not foolish. Women in his stories keep up social appearances. But below the public social level, aristocratic position and wealth meant less than the natural aristocracy of healthy young bodies. All of nature insisted on the right matchup of sexual temperament. It was the old normative, i.e. Mediterranean, view of relations between the sexes, the game in which everyone wins except those unwilling to play. We were back in the paradise from which long ago we had been expelled. In this whole course, Your life is at stake, and particularly at this minute. Montaigne might have laughed at Taylor's professorial melodrama. An aristocrat and public man, he retired to his Bordeaux estate in 1571 at 38 to read and write. Over the years, not all spent in retirement, he made notes on his reading, copying extracts from classical literature, and then adding observation and reflection. Even today, the book that he wrote and rewrote and published and republished, The Essays, seems an utter original. 1,200 years earlier, Augustine had written his spiritual autobiography. Montaigne, who was a Catholic believer, but secular and worldly in temperament, did something perhaps more daring. He made a complete inventory of his physical and mental habits, pursuing his soul, amazingly, in every limb and organ of his body, never losing personal hold of the question of how to live and how to die. Philosophy, theology, manners, the law, and a great many other things pour through his pages, but his main impulse was always autobiographical. Arrogantly, he insisted on his humility. "I set forth a humble and inglorious life," he writes in the famous opening passages of the essay, "of repentance."